welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a glimpse of the real Romney by the authors of a comprehensive biography.
His two books that he's written, he tells very little about himself or his own story. So we really feel that The Globe, we've been covering him for 2 decades, that we can tell the generational saga of the Romneys, his father and even before then, and really what shaped him as he ran for the U.S. Senate and the governorship and now the presidency twice.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Jeremy Denk leads us to the unusual world of nature's music.
Basically, he's saying that humans are narcissistic in our insistence that we're the only musicians on Earth, and that's a big mistake.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Mitt Romney has been seeking the presidency for, it seems, forever now, and yet we still don't know him that well, even after he now looks to have a lock on the Republican nomination. There's an important new comprehensive biography called The Real Romney. It's by Michael Cranish and Scott Hellman. It's reviewed for us by Jeffrey Cabaservice, who says Cranish and Hellman humanize Romney, and they have interviewed seemingly everyone who had contact with him. So I'm delighted that Michael and Scott are here to talk about their book and about Mitt Romney. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Okay, let's start with you, Michael. We've got Romney now riding pretty high. What are some things we ought to know about this guy that we don't?
Well, you really need to know how much his religion does inform his life, how much he was shaped by his father growing up in Michigan. It's interesting. He grew up in this series of bubbles. He said he never really imagined that running for president. And yet a lot of people would say that's exactly what he imagined, that his father failed in 1968.
His father, George Romney, a powerful, important Republican.
Famously or infamously said that he'd been brainwashed by the generals in Vietnam. And that statement played a big role in killing George Romney's campaign. And if you talk to people in the family, and people are quoted in the book saying this, that's made Mitt Romney a lot more careful. Doesn't want to say something so off the script that it would blow his candidacy. And yet we've seen in this campaign that when he has gone off the script, it's been problematic for him. So he's trying to be very careful. As a result, he doesn't like to reveal a lot about himself. His two books that he's written, he tells very little about himself or his own story. So we really feel that The Globe, we've been covering him for 2 decades, that we can tell the generational saga of the Romneys, his father and even before then, and really what shaped him as he ran for the U.S. Senate and the governorship and now the presidency twice.
You know, I've thought about this often, Michael and Scott, that when Newt Gingrich sort of taunted him with the epithet Massachusetts moderate, maybe Massachusetts was almost more important than that, than moderate. But first, what about the religions? You mentioned the religion, the Mormonism. How essential to that is that to Romney? I mean, he's a major figure within the Mormon church. Is that right?
He is, and his family, even going back long before Mitt was born, his family, I mean, we describe his family as one of the sort of first families of Mormonism if you go back to its roots in the 19th century.
Tell us a little bit about that history.
Well, I'll let Michael do the history on the family part because that's his beat.
It's interesting. I was able to do a few years ago in a prior series on Romney to go to Mexico, and the reason for that is that Mitt Romney's great-grandfather, Miles Park Romney, was told by the church, Brigham Young, in fact, to take multiple wives. And then when polygamy was banned in the United States, Mitt's great-grandfather was told to go to Mexico, found a colony where polygamy could continue among the Mormons. And that's what happened. And it's not an ancient story because this is where Mitt's father, George, was born in this Mexican colony, only came to this country when there was a revolution in Mexico. And at 5 years old, George came to this country and built a life for himself. So it really is important to understand this because Miles Park Romney, the great-grandfather, played a huge role in the church. The church gave him a very important role, and there's no question about it. But this is not the kind of thing that Mitt Romney wants to talk about. He has cousins still living in this colony in Mexico. He has not visited there. But it's a really interesting sort of a rollicking wagon wheels in the ruts type of story that helps you get the background for where the Romneys came from and this they have this determination, flight, persecution, rebuilding. It's sort of built into the Romney DNA. And so we use that as a way to sort of help you understand where the Romneys are coming from and how the Romney family gets its strength.
Now, what about Romney in Massachusetts? What was the perception of him when he first ran for office, when he first became a public figure?
When he first became a public figure, this is around 1994, when he decides to challenge Ted Kennedy for Senate. Not that many people knew who he was at all. He was not a household name. He was not even a Republican. He was an independent at this point.
And Scott, at this point, he is running Bain Capital, enormously successful businessman, but not necessarily involved in the civic or political life of Massachusetts?
Not at all. He was not a regular donor. He is not somebody who was even in Republican circles. One of the things that they had to do when he first ran in 94, and his wife said as much, was to figure out who all these people are. Who are the activists? How does this work? How do the Republican caucuses work? Who is a Republican? I mean, they really knew nothing. And at the time, he was very much a Massachusetts moderate, perhaps even a Massachusetts liberal. If you look at the positions he took and how he differentiated himself from Kennedy, I mean, a very, very different political profile than we see from the Mitt Romney today.
Yeah, remind us of some of the positions Romney took.
I mean, a number of things. I mean, the one that most people know, of course, is he was very much pro-choice. I mean, ardently so. He wrote a famous letter to the Log Cabin Republicans trying to seek their endorsement in 94.
The
Republican gay rights group, in which he essentially promised that he would be better than Ted Kennedy. He came out against Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He talked about wanting full equality for gays and lesbians. Now, in fairness, he did not explicitly endorse gay marriage, but it was a pretty, pretty clear message to gay and lesbian voters who had been very key to a Republican Governor William Weld's election a few years earlier. So this was an important constituency. He appealed directly to them. I mean, we could go on and on. He also said he supported a Republican health care bill at the time that would have mandated that everybody in the country buy insurance. These are very different positions, of course, than he has today. So this was the Mitt Romney that Massachusetts got to know and that didn't elect in 94 but liked him as a gubernatorial candidate in 2002. And it's during his time as governor when he starts to look beyond Massachusetts, that's when we see the change.
And what kind of governor was he?
He came in as a very pragmatic governor, somebody who again, was non-ideological, someone who'd been very successful in business, was pragmatic, was going to work with Democrats. You know, he faced a pretty big budget gap when he came in and closed it successfully and gets some credit for that, though he, of course, leaves out the part about raising hundreds of millions of dollars in fees because that gets close to the tax thing. But
what kinds of fees?
Fees on, you know, getting a new driver's license and, I mean, a range of fees. And it was hundreds of millions of dollars a year. It was a big, big chunk of change. So he would classify them as fees, not taxes, which allowed him to say that he closed this enormous budget gap
without
taxes. Right, but of course, when you're closing loopholes and raising fees, you know, it's a semantic argument.
Why did he hold office for just a single term? Did he choose not to run?
He chose not to run again. I think this was always the plan that Massachusetts was going to be a stepping stone to something greater. In fact, 6 months into his term as governor, his advisors were already meeting in Washington and, you know, at a steakhouse to try to hatch this new political action committee whose sole purpose would be to raise money and donate it around the country to strategic Republicans, right? This became what was called the Commonwealth PAC. It was a leadership PAC that he ran to help get his name out there, broaden his profile. So from very early on, they were looking beyond Massachusetts. And I don't think he ever had any intent of actually running for a second term.
Most Americans, I think it's fair to say, don't really know what it is Mitt Romney, President Mitt Romney, really wants to do apart from hold the office. Any reaction to that, Michael?
It's a great question because he doesn't come from this ideological core base. And that's why Republicans and the party on the right have not been thrilled with him. And a lot of the primary has been the anybody but Romney primary because he did set out as a pragmatic. So when we look at it, and all you can look at really is what did he do as a business person and what did he do as governor? So he was at Bain Capital 15 years, the company he founded, and the governorship for 4 years. And in both those cases, he was pragmatic. In the governorship, certainly he worked with Democrats to get the healthcare plan passed, for example. And as a business person, his aim was to make as much money for investors as possible. I mean, that was the aim. He had very wealthy investors, and he did very well by them as far as raising money. It's a different question about what happened to workers at some companies and so forth. But, you know, he did line up what he wanted to accomplish and see how I get there. And it's different than someone like a Rick Santorum who comes from a certain place, and that's where he's always been. So Romney has been these different characters. He has been the liberal, the moderate. Now he says he's severely conservative, quote unquote, but I wouldn't set my hair on fire, unquote. So there have been these different Romneys. All of them are who he is, and understanding that as president, he might draw from all of those places, I helps better understand perhaps as he might be as president.
And I think in some ways it's funny. His message, he can sell himself better, I think, as a president, as a leader, than he can a presidential candidate, if you will. I mean, he has held various leadership positions and shown a tremendous amount of leadership capacity, I think, in several different settings. So I think you can imagine him being an effective president, somebody who would judge the evidence on the ground and listen to people and, again, be pragmatic and not maybe so sort of hidebound to certain positions. But as a candidate, when you're out there trying to sell yourself and you're trying to look people in the eye and show them that you've really got these core convictions and you feel so strongly, that to me feels like a harder sell for him.
And the question is whether if he gets in there as president and there are Democrats controlling one of the House of Congress, will he compromise? And then will the Republican right come after him like they came after George H.W. Bush, when Bush raised taxes to basically end the deficit? So that's what we really would be interested to see if he does become president.
And is it possible then that he might be a more effective candidate in the general election than he was during this very bruising primary battle when so many voters who haven't even really been paying attention? We forget how many voters don't really look close at a presidential race really until the last few weeks. Might he then be more effective as someone who really does have leadership abilities?
I don't think there's any question. And I think that's been clear all along. He's a very attractive in many ways general election candidate. And his hard part, the hard part for him in many ways is to convince conservatives that he's one of them. I mean, we see this in every election, right? Candidates in both parties always tack to the center. They go for the independent voters, the people who are just starting to watch, right? And they always do that. I think one of the risks for Romney is that he has less room to do that because he already has this tag as somebody who's willing to kind of say anything to win. So I feel like he used up all of his lives in some ways. Like he will have a harder time, I feel like, tacking to that middle, in a sort of subtle, clandestine way that a lot of candidates have in the past. So I think that'll be one really interesting dynamic to watch as he does try to, shake up the etch-a-sketch and redraw himself for the general election. Will that past, that record of changing positions sort of overshadow that?
And Michael, what about the Mormonism? I mean, we know many evangelicals do not consider Mormonism Christianity. They think it's a religious cult. It's not a joke. This mystifies some people I talk to. They say, well, Mormons are so successful. They seem so moderate in so many ways. And someone, a colleague at the paper, told me that there's a powerful group. I mean, not to make it sound conspiratorial, but some extremely accomplished Mormons in Boston, at Harvard and MIT. They can be these quite extraordinary people, but there's much of the country, and it's connected, allied with that Republican base that doesn't trust him. Will he have the mission, as it were, to persuade these voters that he's a Christian just like them?
Well, he needs to bring along Republicans who were skeptical of him. So there's no doubt he needs to bring their passion along. So if these people still maintain that they can't vote for him because they don't believe that he's a real Christian, that could be a problem for him. There are some polls that actually suggest that a large number of Democrats don't want to vote for a Mormon. But I've looked at those polls and I wonder whether that is simply because when they see that, they see Mormon and they hear Romney. So they know that's the Mormon candidate. Some of the polls would lead you to think that perhaps a lot of Democrats would also have a big problem. But, the conventional wisdom has been if he gets past the Republican primaries, that the issue won't be anywhere near as big for him as it will be in the general. It really wasn't an issue when he ran for governor, for example, in Massachusetts. So if he's gotten this far, they hope certainly that it's not going to be an issue as long as they can bring along a lot of the Republicans who've had questions so far.
Romney has been kind of hardened and schooled and healed through this process. He's made some mistakes. He's also had some successes. Either or both of you, is he going to be a strong and plausible candidate against Barack Obama in the fall? Scott?
I think he can certainly be that candidate. I think he has the potential to be a really strong general election candidate. I think certainly his message, assuming the economy remains sort of uncertain in what it wants to do and how far it's progressing, I mean, his economic message is well-timed in that way. At the same time, I think the primary process has shown us that he does have some real weaknesses. And it's not that just that he has been beaten up and that all these attacks by Newt Gingrich are going to resurface. That we see every time. I think it's more how has he dealt with those attacks and how has he fought back. And I mean, this primary campaign has gone on longer than I think a lot of people expected. And I think that's in part because he's unsuccessfully been able to parry the attacks and have a sort of successful counteroffensive. He's not been able to talk about his wealth in a terribly effective, reassuring way. He's not connected with people. I think those things remain real risks for him, along with what Michael said about can he get conservatives to come out and vote? Will they actually – we know they don't like Obama, but is that enough to get them to the polls? We'll see.
He's very bruised, but on the very big picture, you have a much clearer definition of who the candidates are. In the primaries, really, they were battling at the margins despite all of the very harsh rhetoric that was used. Here, there's really no question that there are very big distinctions between Obama and Romney. So he'll be able to draw those distinctions much more deeply and try to heal some of the wounds that have been caused by the
primaries.
What
are some of the distinctions with Obama that he
Well, for example, he wants to get rid of President Obama's health care plan and put in something different. He hasn't really been totally clear on what he would do if the states start repealing them on day one, as Romney wants. So that's a very big thing. He doesn't want to raise taxes at all, and Obama has said that they should be raised on the wealthiest Americans. He's been more hawkish on foreign policy than Obama has been, although you can drill down and question whether he's really that different. Romney wants to dramatically, and I mean dramatically, increase defense spending. He wants it to be 4% of the gross domestic product, where it's something closer to 3% right now. So it would be a very large increase, and Obama's has counted on some cuts or keeping it stable to get rid of the deficit. So they have a lot of differences on financial issues, on foreign policy, defense, and healthcare.
Well, it's going to be interesting to watch the two of them go at it. Michael Cranish and Scott Hellman, thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And their book, The Real Romney, is reviewed in this week's Book Review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So has Amazon won again?
It looks like Amazon had a very good day this week. As we've been expecting for months, the Justice Department filed a lawsuit against Apple and five of the biggest book publishers in the business. They announced shortly after that that three of those publishers had agreed to a tentative settlement of the lawsuit.
Julie, this is a battle about the pricing of ebooks. Is that right? Where Amazon, which is this enormous dominant player in the field, particularly when it comes to ebooks, has differences with the book publishers about how much customers should pay for ebooks. Is that right?
That's right. If you go back to 2 years ago, in 2010, the price of an ebook was generally about $9.99, and that was a price that Amazon had set.
And that's where people were getting their ebooks, or most of them, right?
Most of them were. You know, Barnes & Noble had just opened its ebook store. The Nook had only come out in October 2009. So Amazon was very early to this market, and they decided that newly released and best-selling ebooks were going to cost $9.99. Now, the reason they could set this price is that publishers and Amazon had set up contracts that allowed Amazon to sell ebooks in a similar way that print books were sold, and that's on the wholesale model. The wholesale model, described very simply, is that the publisher takes a book, let's say a $26 book, sells it to the retailer for about half of that, so say $13, and then the retailer sells that book for whatever they want to sell it for.
And what was the problem?
The problem was that, in the publisher's eyes, was that Amazon was selling ebooks for below cost. So Amazon was buying a $26 book for $13 and selling it for $9.99. Now, publishers felt that this undercut what an ebook should cost. Granted, this was a time when people were just beginning to buy e-readers, they were just learning what a Kindle was, and that $9.99 was getting stuck in people's heads as what an ebook should cost, where publishers felt that when a hardcover book cost much more than that, there was too much of a price disparity.
Now, if Amazon is selling them ebooks for less than they, Amazon, are buying the rights to sell that book for, what's in it for Amazon? Why would they want to sell them at so low a price?
Well, for Amazon, they were willing to take a lower price on those ebooks because they were trying to create an incentive for consumers to buy the Kindle device. And at this time, you know, it was new. People were just kind of figuring out what this was. But they thought, well, $9.99 is a very cheap price for a book. So if I spend $300 or $400 on this Kindle, then I'm getting a great deal on ebooks.
And since Amazon manufactures and sells the Kindle, they were making money on the sales of those devices and could afford to take a smaller fee, make a smaller profit, or no profit at all, a loss, as you say, on the ebook. Was there also a question that if Amazon could position itself as the one kind of Walmart where everybody's getting their ebooks, then eventually they can raise the price because people won't buy them anywhere else?
Well, that's what the publishers were worried, that Amazon was going to take over the market and essentially monopolize it. And that other retailers like Barnes & Noble, Apple, Google, all of these other retailers wanted to get into the book business, the ebook business, that is, but they were concerned at the time that ebooks were just priced too low for it to make sense to them for a business standpoint.
So then what happened was, if I understand, these giant publishers like Simon & Schuster and Penguin and HarperCollins and Hachette, some of these very big companies, banded together and said, no, we refuse to have the book sold at this lower price. There should be a higher price.
Well, as the publishers would describe it, they say that they made individual decisions to switch from a wholesale model to the agency model. And the way the agency model worked, quite simply, is that the publisher set the price for the book. They sold the book to the retailer, and the retailer took a 30% commission on the price of each book. So this put the question of what an ebook costs back into the publisher's hands. And this all came about when Steve Jobs, who was then the chief executive of Apple, was getting into the book business for Apple, starting the iBookstore, and told publishers individually, look, you know, I want to sell you books on an agency model. This will be better for you in the long run. And why don't you renegotiate all of your contracts with Amazon and everybody else and get them over to the agency model too? Now, what we know is that that happened, that five of the big six publishers convinced Amazon to move over to the agency model, and the price of books went up.
Now, why did the Department of Justice get involved?
Well, the Department of Justice has charged that these five publishers and Apple illegally colluded to raise the price of ebooks.
Price fixing.
Price fixing. You know, they're saying that this was a scheme that came together over lunches and breakfasts at upscale Manhattan restaurants. They outlined in their complaint private dinners with the chief executives of these publishing companies where they discussed business matters. They put together a months-long investigation, and along the way have pressured publishers to settle to avoid a long trial. And three of the publishers agreed to do that. They all said this week that they had done nothing wrong, that they hadn't broken any laws, but because they couldn't afford to fight the Justice Department, they had to settle. Now, two other publishers, Penguin and Macmillan, also said that they had done nothing wrong, but they also said that they were willing to risk being sued, which it looks like is happening now.
So they're not part of this settlement. They're going
right.
to keep the fight going.
Apple and Penguin and Macmillan have all said, so sue us.
Now, what's the argument they make in defense of having raised the prices? Isn't the perception among the book publishers is that Amazon's not the victim here. Amazon is this great big bully. And what argument do the publishers make about the dangers of the Justice Department's interpretation of what happened?
Well, the publishers say that the Department of Justice is taking a very short view on this, that they're saying that the Justice Department saw ebook prices go up and therefore assumed that there was some illegal activity. Now, what publishers are predicting will happen in the long run is that Amazon will simply corner the market again. They'll be able to lower books because the price of ebooks. Now publishers who have settled have to go back and renegotiate all of their contracts with their retailers that sell ebooks. They agreed in the settlement that they cannot restrict retailers from discounting books. Now, they don't necessarily have to go back to a wholesale model, but what they've agreed to if they stay with the agency model is essentially an agency model without teeth.
And are the publishers also arguing that in the name of or with the intention of breaking this monopoly of publishers, they're actually creating another bigger monopoly with Amazon?
In the long run, that's what a lot of publishers and authors are predicting. Now, what we know is that Amazon has promised to lower the price of ebooks in response to this. They were quite eager to put out that statement after the news of the settlement was announced. So it looks like the question of what an ebook costs is far from settled.
Julie, you mentioned authors, and they're the species we've left out of this conversation. Where do they stand on, in the broadest sense, this whole question of ebooks and Amazon purchases as opposed to, you know, you have the dream of being an author with your hardcover book and you sign it in the bookstore? Do authors worry that some of the traditions of being a published writer are going to disappear?
Sure. I think that a lot of authors are traditionalists. They love paper. They love their hardcover books. But I think that a lot of them are also just kind of facing the realities that this is the way that things are going, that a lot of Americans now prefer to read in digital form. So I think that most authors will say that they want their books to be sold wherever and whenever they can in whatever format they can find.
And this latest development is just one chapter in what will be a very long narrative about this conflict between Amazon and traditional publishers. Is that right?
Absolutely. I don't think you've heard the end of it.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Every once in a while, a book comes along that is really on a subject that never would have crossed your mind for someone to write about. There's one this week on our cover. It's called The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places. It's reviewed for us by a great writer and concert pianist, Jeremy Denk, who is the author of the blog Think Denk, and he's here to talk about it. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you.
So Bernie Krause, the author of this book, has kind of done an interesting thing. He sort of discovered this symphony in nature.
Yeah, well, he's devoted his life to this topic, and it sounds like sort of in the late 60s he reached a little bit of an impasse in his musical exploration.
Yeah, tell us who he is.
Well, he it's hard to say. He was a musician. He ended up replacing Pete Seeger.
In the Weavers?
In the Weavers, right. And he was working then in electronic music, and he did some early albums in electronic music for Nonesuch Records.
Nonesuch Records.
Yeah, wow. Back in the sort of late 60s. And sounds like it was good times, you know. And then he sort of burned out on it, I think. And he explains in this book how he went to the Muir Woods to record, you know, natural sounds, and it was a revelation for him.
Well, and you say he's actually done some extraordinary work in this book. What story is he telling us?
He's telling us, well, he's gone to all these places where humans still haven't destroyed the natural soundscapes, and he's sort of scientifically recording what's going on, and he's comparing these...
Where's he gone?
Well, he's gone to Costa Rica a lot. He's gone to Africa a lot, sort of, I forget, in Kenya there's a couple places, Borneo, I think. There's a ton of... All over, wherever the human sonic imprint hasn't obliterated everything.
So he goes there with recording equipment.
Yes.
And records the sounds around him, animal sounds.
Animal sounds, hippo grunts, insect drones, God knows, bird song. He's interested also not just in animal sounds, but in the general sounds, you know. The sounds of nature. The way that trees rustle, the way that, he even records at one point, I think, the sound of an iceberg moving somehow at great risk to himself.
First of all, how does he describe that in text? This is not a CD, so you don't hear any of this. How does he tell his story?
Well, he uses a lot of – there's a lot of extravagant language and a lot of epithets. And then there are also graphs. He shows you spectrographs of these sonic textures that gives you a real feeling of how they're like – in a way like musical scores of Mozart or Brahms or whatever – These spectrographs are beautiful to look at. Yeah, absolutely. And I could see, you know, easily how all the various voices interact in a way very similar to musical scores, you know. And actually many, I think, composers of the 20th century eventually decided to imitate these aspects of nature and make their scores more like nature's scores.
Is that part of his argument, that human sounds or the very organized orchestral or symphonic music of, you know, the most refined and rarefied sort actually has its origins in the sounds of nature? Is he making a case like that?
His argument is really big and broad. It's even bigger that all of our music derives from this primordial music of nature and that we ignore it at our peril.
Right. You said there's a crusading dimension to this book.
Yeah.
Right? He's kind of an over-the-top guy. What are some of the more exaggerated or heightened claims that he makes?
He goes on a pretty extended attack on Western music and how we've ignored the natural rhythms, natural sounds.
Now, when you say Western music, he means the whole range?
Basically Western classical music. Well, even I think probably dating from 900 on or something like that. He's talking about how in our quest for organization and this sort of, what's the word, teleological way that we go about writing music and this sort of our obsession with ourselves. Basically, he's saying that humans are narcissistic in our insistence that we're the only musicians on earth, and that's a big mistake.
Now, you say the Western tradition. Does he look more favorably on other traditions, or doesn't he discuss them so much?
He does a little bit, yeah. He discusses wonderfully in one place the pygmies, the Baka pygmies. I forget what region of Africa they're from. But as it happens, a very important 20th century classical composer, Ligeti, was obsessed with these pygmies and their music. And he describes the way they sang together and what they did. And that's one of my favorite passages in the book. And so he does explain that some of these – and also I think it's the Yanomami at one point. He talks about how they basically use nature as a karaoke machine and they sort of improv and riff off the existing, you know, raindrops or the rustle of trees, and they use it as their kind of material to make music with and on.
Is this something musicologists will look at in a serious way? Is he writing for musicians like yourself or for ordinary readers? Does he tell this in a narrative way that so they'll be will hold the interest of a reader and also explanatory enough that we can follow what he's talking about?
Or? Oh, yeah. It's totally for an everyday reader. And maybe sometimes I wish it was even more – I mean, I'm the kind of nerdy person who wants it to be even a little more wonky and scientific at times. But, I mean, he goes back and forth between, you know, very much autobiography and hilarious stories of recording, you know, crocodiles that suddenly pop up and being amid like a guerrilla argument and almost – kind of getting killed, but the, you know, the incredible musical sound of these two gorillas approaching from either side. So the stories, I mean, the book is extremely readable, extremely layperson friendly. And I think that for him, there's not really a distinction between the sort of higher end scientific element of it and the sort of more personal connection to it.
Do we know what he's doing with all these recordings? I mean, are they preserved somewhere or
yes,
we hear them?
He has archived and actually there's a few YouTube videos that are affiliated with the book that I recommend, like 5-minute snippets of various ecosystems and climates.
How do we find those? Just plug in his name, Bernie Krause?
Yeah, on YouTube. I think that the publisher has put them out to go with the book a little bit, and there's like 5 minutes of a desert and 5 minutes of the jungle and 5 minutes of various things. And they're very, very wonderful, and it makes you want – actually, I want these whole CDs that he's made.
Oh, so he has CDs too, and
yes.
That's probably – that may be the best way to read or listen to this book.
Yeah. I mean, I'm desperate to get my hands on some of these because he writes about them in such a way that you really crave hearing them.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
Yeah.
That's Jeremy Denk, who reviews The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places by Bernie Krause on the cover of this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
There is a lot of turnover on the list, actually. We could fill up the rest of the show with it. On the fiction side of things, there's a new number one title. It's The Lost Years by Mary Higgins Clark. It's about the discovery of a letter by Jesus and the murder of the scholar who discovers that. Her daughter, Carol Higgins Clark, is also new on the list this week, down at number 11 with a book called Gypped. That's part of a mystery series that she's been writing for some years now, featuring a detective named Regan Riley. New at number 3 is a book called Sacre Bleu by Christopher Moore about Vincent van Gogh.
It's a novel? Is number 3?
It's a novel, yes. It's it imagines that Van Gogh's friends are examining or trying to figure out whether he really killed himself or not. And so it's a historical novel set in the art world of that time. Number 4 is the new Alexander McCall Smith mystery, the Limpopo Academy of Private Detection. That's the newest from his number 1 Ladies Detective Agency series. At number 5 is a book called The Shoemaker's Wife, a historical romance by Adriana Trigiani. It's based on her Italian-American grandparents. They were immigrants to America who knew each other in Italy but became romantically involved once they arrived in America. Down at number 8, the new Anne Tyler is on the list, The Beginner's Goodbye. It's getting some mixed reviews, but she makes pretty regular appearances on the list at this point in her career. Number 10, a Donna Leon mystery called Beastly Things. She's the woman who writes these Venetian mysteries, inspector in Venice. The Carol Higgins Clark I told you about. Then there are new titles also at number 14 and 15. I'm telling you, it's
this
a lot
is
of new titles.
Quite the churn.
Yeah. So at number 14 is a book called The Big Catnap by Rita Mae Brown and Sneaky Pie Brown, who I believe is her cat, who gets writing credit at this point.
Her cat gets writing credit?
Yeah, I'll need to check myself on this afterward.
But now somebody else did that. Was it Barbara Bush, whose dog, Millie, was the author of a book? Or?
Yeah, that I believe they called a nonfiction book.
That's right. There was some controversy about that.
That's right. And then at number 15, another mystery by Anne Perry, a book called Dorchester Terrace. That's the new books on the fiction side of the list. On the nonfiction side, there's also a lot of turnover. New at number 15 is a book called Rebuild the Dream. That's by the former Obama green jobs advisor Van Jones.
Oh, yes, who was enmeshed in great controversy. I seem to remember he's the one who was essentially kind of driven out of office by Glenn Beck, right? He accused him of being – I forget what he'd done, sign a petition or something or other.
That was for about 5 minutes there, he was a flashpoint of the right-wing talk shows.
That's right, yeah. So now he's on the bestseller list. Who else?
At number 14, a book by a woman named Stephanie Nielsen called Heaven is Here. She's a popular blogger about her life as a mother. She's Mormon, and she and her husband were in a plane crash together, and this is a book about their recovery from that and how their faith and optimism helped them through that. At number 12, Harvey Arden, the Times' own sports writer, with a book called Driving Mr. Yogi, about the relationship between Ron Guidry and Yogi Berra during their spring training. At number 11, a book by a woman named Kelly Hampton called Bloom. That's about the first year of her baby's life. Her baby has Down syndrome, and she's writing what it's like raising a child with Downs. At number 5, a book by Clint Hill called Mrs. Kennedy and Me. He was a Secret Service agent assigned to guard Jacqueline Kennedy, and he was actually present at the assassination. He was stationed on the fender of one car right behind the president's car, and when the shots rang out, he ran forward and pushed Mrs. Kennedy down in the seat, tried to protect the president. Didn't obviously make it in time, and was tortured by that, really haunted by it for a long time. In 1975, in the early days of 60 Minutes, Mike Wallace interviewed him, and he was really kind of tortured. He grimaced a lot. He was smoking. He looked just really pained, talking about how he wishes he could have gotten there a fraction of a second faster, and he could have taken that third shot himself, the shot that actually killed the president.
So that story must have been the basis of the Clint Eastwood film, Line
of
Fire.
It was, yes. In fact, when the Clint Eastwood film came out, there was some renewed attention on Clint Hill. They said, here's the real Clint, who really did try to save the president. And then Michael Savage has a new book at number three.
He's the radio talk show guy.
Yes, also one of these conservative talk show hosts. And his book is called Trickle Down Tyranny, the expected stuff about President Obama as a fascist and how he's just power hungry and what we all can do to rise up against him.
So you're saying that's not true?
I didn't say it wasn't true. It's on the nonfiction list. It must be true.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.